The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the Church in the world and kind of just love. Just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, and just love yourself. Well, you know, this week we're getting ready. This is kind of like maybe the week before Christmas, but not really Christmas. But everybody, and I mean everybody, not just us Catholic types, but bunches of different types of people are really, really getting excited about the fact that Pope Francis is coming here next week. And this is just incredibly important for us, but not merely on the Catholic Channel, but this is important for us as a country, as a nation, and as a hemisphere, because if we were to think, as like the popes have asked us to think over the years, that we're part of the Americas, that we have now an American pope. Angie, did you know we have an American pope now in Pope Francis?
No, I did not know that.
Well, do you know why I'm saying we got an American pope?
No.
Well, because what do we got? We got North America. We got South America.
Yes.
He's
from Argentina.
And is Argentina part of South America?
Yes.
Does South America have America in it?
It does.
All right. So he's an American pope.
That Yes, if you spin it that way, he is American.
Hey, I'm not spinning. I'm speaking the truth. That's what I'm doing. But do you know how America got to be called America?
No.
Do you know?
I think.
Come on, Tom.
I think, Monsignor, was it because of Amerigo Vespucci?
You got it. You got it. And what about him?
He was I'm going to say he was an explorer after Columbus, and I guess no.
Angie, come on. Can you educate Tom?
Do
you
know what he was? Explorer.
No, I couldn't hear you.
He was a cartologist.
Oh, okay.
A cartologist.
He made maps?
No, he made carts.
Yes. He made carts.
No, he made maps, yes.
Okay.
He made maps.
Okay.
And he was, and I'm not going to get this exactly right, but he was one of the first map makers who drew a map of what we now call the United States.
Oh.
And so it was got to be named after him, America.
Wow.
That's how come it got the name from an Italian map maker who was one of the first people who did the map of the land of the United States.
Wow. That is quite a legacy to leave behind.
Isn't that?
Right
isn't
place,
that?
Right time.
You know, it is a wonderful, wonderful thing. I mean, you know, we don't call it, you know, Columbus only gets a country in South America.
Yeah, that's true.
And
right?
he did all the trips over here and all that type of stuff and all of those type of things. So, but anyway, but in kind of going back to our main point is it was actually Pope John Paul II who basically asked the people of the Western Hemisphere, basically North America, South America, to think of themselves as part of a kind of a unit, to think of themselves as the Americas, because he wanted to create a sense of solidarity between the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere, and to realize that developing countries and those countries that are more developed need to have a partnership and a collaboration and a solidarity. So he was the one in some of his writings he would talk about. At times, I think he would use the church in the Americas. And so that was, and here's a little bit of a kind of inside church thing. Most countries, most continents, most places kind of get a patron. You know, a special saint person who they're supposed to pray for and hope that that saint kind of protects them in a special way. So who do you think the patron saint of the Americas are? I'll give you a hint.
Okay.
If I asked you who's patron saint of Mexico, would you be able to tell me that? Angie, if you don't know that, and you're from Texas, I don't know. We're going to take away your Texas identity.
don't, because I don't know.
You don't know.
Tejas?
What?
Tejas?
Tejas.
That's Texas in Spanish.
Oh, that, I thought you don't tell me it's Dos Equis. You think it's
Dos Equis? It's, yeah.
No, it's the tequila. Patron saint of the Americas is not a beer. And it's not. Tom, do you know?
Is it Our Lady of Guadalupe?
Yes, Our Lady of Guadalupe. Angie, you knew it. You just kind of got hidden deep.
It took me a while.
Yeah. So anyway, so basically, what it was actually, I think, Pope John Paul II who wanted to make Our Lady of Guadalupe not merely the patron of Mexico, but of the Americas. And actually, we use the same title of Mary. Mary under the title of the Immaculate Conception for the mm-hmm. United States. So that was something there. So going back to my main point, that we're getting a visit by an American Pope. Now, so I think that's pretty good.
That's
fabulous. It's fabulous. Now, but the other thing is, this is a little bit of a thing, which I also think is pretty important too. Pretty important too. So which visit of Pope Francis... Mm-hmm. Even when he was not Pope Francis, but was Cardinal Bishop Jorge Bergoglio, I think that's his name, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which visit of him to the United States will it be? How many times has he been here before?
This will be his first.
Yes!
Ding, ding,
Woo!
Ding.
Okay, so this is going to be his first. And I think, you know, I think that's a very important thing for us as citizens and people of the United States, is because it reminds us that we're part of the whole world. And sometimes we in the United States sometimes can get a little bit of sense that, you know, we're the center of the world sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Now, Angie, Texas thinks it's the center of the United States.
Oh, it surely is.
Yeah, I know. You think that at some point. But anyway, so I think it's good to realize that, you know, we're part of the world. And this is the first time that the Pope had a pretty good career without visiting here before. So
for sure.
I think it puts us in context so that when we receive him, we welcome him for his first visit. And it reminds us that we're part of a whole world and we're part of the Americas. Mm-hmm. So if we want to call him an American Pope, which I think we should, it's because he's from the America to the south of us where he's coming from. So it's just going to be a great trip. It's a great trip. He's going to Cuba. And I was in Cuba when his predecessor, John Paul II, went to Cuba. So I'm so happy that he's going back to Cuba. No, he's going back, but the Pope is going back to Cuba. I think that's great. And then he's going to hang out for a day or so in Washington, D.C. And then he's coming to New York and then to Philadelphia. And so this is just kind of a great, great trip. And, you know, we got a little bias, okay? We got a little bias because he's visiting with immigrants and refugees that are being helped by Catholic Charities when he comes to New York. So we kind of think that that's the high point of his trip.
It is. I'm sure it is.
It is. And the second high point, we think, is when he goes in Washington, D.C., to eat with and to help serve a meal with some of the hungry people and some of the homeless people that are served by Catholic Charities in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. So we kind of think that's the second most important part of the trip that he does. And then it's also important because in Philadelphia, he's going to go to a prison and visit with prisoners. And so many Catholic Charities programs reach out to prisoners, and sometimes when prisoners are coming out of jail or out of prison, they try to do programs to help them re-enter society. And sometimes we do programs, as we do in New York, Catholic Charities tries to provide alternatives to incarceration. So I know, there's going to be a lot of hype that the Pope's going to talk to a joint session of Congress. I also know there's going to be a lot of hype that he's talking to the United Nations, okay? Mm-hmm. But we know the really important parts of his trip is when he meets with those immigrants and refugees helped by Catholic Charities in East Harlem, when he meets with those people helped by Catholic Charities in Washington, D.C., and helps serve a meal to them, mm-hmm. and then when he goes and visits with a prisoners in Philadelphia. So kind of we think that's kind of a really, you know, high part of his trip. So
because he's a Jesuit, right?
He's a Jesuit.
Okay.
And you know what that means?
Kind of. I'm very new to this, so you might have to enlighten me a little bit.
Well, basically, over the history of the church, because there were special needs that arose in different times of history and like even before I was born, like centuries ago and stuff like that. So different things happened, okay? And oftentimes people got inspired and they said, you know, we want to address this problem. Mm-hmm. So, and the problem, one of the problems that came up in the 16th century was that that there was division in the church and they needed people who could talk about the faith in a way that was true and try mm-hmm. to get people not to get the wrong interpretation of the faith. There's a Protestant Reformation. And so this group of men came together who said, we want to kind of really be a people who are in the forefront of trying to explain the faith right, trying to make sure it gets protected and it's served well. And so they formed a community of committed men who became a religious community called the Society of Jesus or the Jesuits. And so that's how the Jesuits came to be. In another century, and actually since we're talking about Pope Francis, one of the reasons that it's the other big religious mm-hmm. community are, what do you think? If he's called Pope Franciscus, what do you think this other group is called?
Franciscans?
Yes.
Ding, ding, ding.
Really?
Yep. They're called it. Franciscans.
Woohoo.
And Francis, and one of the reasons why he took the name Francis was for two or three reasons. One is Francis in... Tom, do you know what century that was?
Francis was, I think, the 1300s?
I think so. Mm-hmm. I think so. In Italy. And he was born into a pretty well-to-do family. Mm-hmm. And he basically said, he didn't like that stuff. He wanted to be much more simple. And so he kind of gave up his inheritance and did all of that stuff. And he formed a community of men who were going to live a very simple life with a great respect for nature and animals and stuff like that, and a great help and love for the poor. And so Francis formed a community called the Franciscans. And the other thing he kind of is attributed to him is that sometimes the church gets things a little bit wrong. They get it too complicated. They maybe get things that are part of it that kind of distract everybody. Mm-hmm. So part of what he wanted to do was to renew the church and get it back to the roots of Jesus and the gospel. And this is a perfect segue. That's why current Pope took the name Francis, because he wanted to communicate as Saint Francis of like 700 years ago that we need to be more simple. We need to be concerned about the poor. And if we do that, then we're going to renew the church. And so that's why he chose Pope Francis as his name.
That is very interesting.
Yeah, not bad, right? Not bad.
Not bad at all.
Not bad at all. So you know what I think we're going to do? Why don't we take a break now? And then when we come back, we'll go to our first guest, who is Michael Clausen, who works at Save the Children. And we're going to talk, sadly, about one of the items that is really high on the agenda of Pope Francis. We're going to talk about the refugee crisis in the world. And so this is Just Love, and we're going to take a two-minute break. Come back when we will talk with Michael Clausen from Save the Children about the refugee crisis in the world and what humanitarian things are going on to help that. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. This is Just Love on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world and various issues that affect our world and the common good. But we call it Just Love because we say just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. Well, we got a problem in the world right now. We got people fleeing all over the world, tens of millions of refugees throughout the world. In the past year, the number of refugees have grown by the millions, and we're in a situation which I don't think it's an exaggeration to say we got a crisis. And so we're delighted that Michael Clausen, the Vice President for Policy and Humanitarian Response of Save the Children, has kind of agreed to kind of join us on Just Love for a little bit of time to talk a little bit about what's going on in the world. Michael, thank you so much for being with us today on Just Love.
You're very welcome, and I really appreciate the spotlight you're shining on this issue.
Well, so, Michael, give our listeners a little bit of sense there throughout the country, a little bit of your own history and how you got to your current position with Save the Children, and, you know, give us a little bit of a sense of what you've done, who you are.
Sure. So I joined Save the Children not quite 10 years ago. It was a career change for me. I used to be in the diplomatic service and spent a lot of time working on foreign policy issues at home and abroad. And for family reasons, I really had to come back and stay in the U.S. And so I wanted the common theme in the work I was doing before in Save the Children is really trying to work on ways that you can make the world a better place. And I think Save the Children, the opportunity that presented by Save the Children, really gave me an chance to do that much more directly. I mean, and this is a fabulous organization, and we're working in 60 countries around the world where we have programs, and probably another 40. We do what our name says. It's really, you know, trying to make the world a better place for children working on education or health, that type of thing. And one of the areas that we're particularly focused on now is the fact that the number of people that have been, you know, forced out of their homes and either remain in their countries or have crossed borders is really at an all-time high since World War II.
Now, I think I read a number, if you count those who are displaced within their own countries and those who are displaced and refugees across countries, it's getting close to 60 million people.
Well, the total number of people displaced in that fashion and who are refugees is 60 million. The number of people who are refugees, meaning that they, you know, are forced out of their homes and they've moved, they have to cross borders. That's essentially it's almost 20 million. So it's basically the population of New York State. So if you imagine everybody in New York State being forced out of the country, that's the global situation we're dealing with, and a significant portion of those are in the Middle East.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and I don't want to get distracted, but when I was kind of reading a little bit about this, one of the things that I was surprised here in the Americas, I think there are millions of displaced Colombians because of the drug wars in Colombia. I was just amazed at how large that number was.
I'm sort of focused on the Middle East and Africa at the moment, so I don't have a real handle on the numbers. But I think there are obviously large numbers of displaced in our own hemisphere.
Yeah, I mean, I saw the number. I couldn't believe it. So like almost 6 million displaced people in Colombia. It just was so really surprising to me when I saw that number.
I think the world we're in is a really interesting time because world leaders, you were talking earlier about the Pope coming to the United States. He's going to be up at this summit meeting of world leaders in 2 weeks for the next generation of goals that would guide world efforts. So they're called the Sustainable Goals will be developed. And on the one hand, you see enormous progress that's been made over the last 20 years or so. I mean, dramatic reductions in, you know, what we're focused on, child mortality, dramatic increases in children enrolled in school and so forth. And yet that sits alongside really challenging circumstances, increased conflict, a lot of much larger, more complex natural disasters that we're facing. So there's sort of a duality going on in the world.
So, Michael, the work of Save the Children, as you said, is in 60 countries, and it tries to provide help, aid, support, development to children, whether they are refugees or not, whether there's a disaster or not, whether it's just an ongoing issue. But having said that, I assume when crises come along, whether they be, and because I know you know a little bit about this, a natural disaster such as an earthquake in Haiti, or whatever we want to call this, a human disaster of the flood of refugees, Middle East and Europe, I bet you that's got to impact the work of Save Our Children, and you kind of adjust what you're doing to deal with those crises.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you deal with first things first, and that's, we are an organization that is both working sort of everyday poverty issues and trying to help societies and particularly families and children lift themselves out of poverty and build the institutions and skills you need to do that. But then when conflict strikes or disaster strikes, you know, first things first. And so in a situation, as we've seen, you know, Nepal is a recent example. Last April, when the earthquake struck Nepal, we, both our colleagues in Nepal itself and then those that were involved in the emergency response work, we immediately turned to that. And within, I had some of my colleagues here based in D.C. On planes to go out to Nepal within, you know, within a day. Because often when you have a very large scale disaster, our country program needs additional help to be able to work with local partners and deal with it, and that's certainly the case in the Middle East at the moment. And it's you know, sadly, it's a very protracted situation where this conflict has been going. It's almost into its fifth year in Syria, and it's affecting all of the neighborhood. And as we've seen in the last couple of weeks, it's also now, it's engulfed the Middle East, it's extended into Europe. We're working in the Middle East to do what we can to help families that are caught in these circumstances.
We're speaking with Michael Clausen, who is the Vice President for Policy and Humanitarian Response at Save the Children, a humanitarian organization that, you know, tries to lift children out of poverty in quote-unquote good times and has done a tremendous amount of good work. And then in the bad times of disasters, steps up to the plate to do what needs to be done to alleviate some of that suffering. So, Michael, give our listeners a little sense what's going on in the Middle East. Kind of I know it's so complicated, but give a snapshot to our listeners of the refugee crises in the Middle East.
Well, I think that the one that we're most focused on is really the civil conflict that's taking place in Syria and has been taking place the last 4.5 years or so. And as a consequence of that, we work both inside Syria but also in the neighboring countries, and we have to work in those neighboring countries because large numbers of Syrians have felt so insecure and threatened that they've left their country. You have roughly 4 million Syrians that are. Felt so threatened that they've gone to Jordan or to Lebanon or to Iraq or Egypt. And so we are working with, and most of them are not, which if you imagine refugees, often the idea of a big camp comes to mind. There is a fairly large camp in Jordan, but the bulk of refugees, even in Jordan, they're interspersed across the country in a lot of different ways. They're just sort of merging into the host community. And so what we do in those countries is really support providing health services, trying to provide some educational services. Where one of the challenges often is the refugees in many of these countries, it's not legal for them to work, and so there's a real challenges in them being able to support themselves while they're refugees. And so UN organizations are involved, and we would partner with in the case of Jordan and Lebanon, for example, with the World Food Program, and we're involved in helping refugees get vouchers and use these e-cards that they can to get food. So it's a whole variety of kinds of things. I would say, I think having visited our work quite a few times now, what I saw, I think the international assistance is making a difference. I mean, often since we're focused particularly on children, let me just talk a little bit about that.
Before you do that, Mike. So 4 million refugees. What's the population of Syria?
Population of Syria is around 20.
So in other words, that's 20% of the country.
Yeah, about half the country is displaced either as refugees or internally.
Now, you know, I think to our listeners, I mean, who we're familiar in the United States, in some of our urban areas, with the issues of kind of street homelessness. Now, if I think about refugee, and you mentioned job, you mentioned food, and you mentioned that, you know, you do have some large camp or camps, but everybody else just blends into the population, it seems to be the first thing you think about, well, are they sleeping on the streets or are they doubling up or where are they staying when they go there?
Well, I mean, a lot of those that have been able to leave, they do have initially upon arrival, they have some assets that they were able to, you know, whatever they were able to cobble again with them. So some of them actually are staying in, they're not in the nice parts of town. They're in the much less nice parts of town, but they are able to rent apartments and sometimes stay with family and that type of thing.
Okay.
When I was in Amman and Beirut, I did not see a lot of people out on the street, but you see, I mean, it's a real mixture of the way people are fending. And one of the reasons people are now more on the move is that the world support for these UN organizations is drying up, and as a consequence, vouchers for a lot of these families are being cut. And so if you can't work and if you're not getting support from the international community, what do you do?
Right. So, Michael, I interrupted you. We're speaking with Michael Clausen, who is the Vice President for Policy and Humanitarian Relief at Save the Children. You were going to talk about children because that's a specific focus of your organization.
Right. So I just wanted to say that one of the sort of heartening things about the work that I'm involved in, and as I think you've been talking about it, this is a very tough period for, you know, large numbers of people across the world. But when the assistance that we are able to provide to make things a little better for them really does make a difference. And when I've been in the Za'atari refugee camp, which is the largest one in Jordan, I was able to see some of the children that were benefiting from our programs, whether it's, you know, early childhood or things like that. And the good news is that these are not kids who are, these are kids who are energized and engaged and involved in the activities. So they're being reached, they're being helped. There's a real sense that we're kind of keeping alive their hopes, if you will. And when you talk to them, I mean, you get a sense that most they want to go back to their country, but it's, you know, it needs to be stable and secure and safe for them to be able to do it. But that's their hope, is to go back to their country. And when they're drawing pictures of, and these are sort of 10, 12 year olds, they're drawing pictures of what it was like back in their neighborhood and things like that. And then when you ask them sort of, what do you want to do? When you're grown up, I mean, one young girl was telling me about how she dreamed to be a doctor. Now, in her case, that's a wonderful ambition to have, but her father was missing and her brother's hands were so severely beaten he couldn't work. So there's a personal connection to being a doctor. But I mean, I think the support that Save the Children gets from Americans and the support that the U.S. government is providing, I think is making a difference in the lives of people in that I saw that are Syrian refugees.
Yeah, Michael, I think two things you said I think are worth my kind of raising up for our listeners. One is that sometimes when we see those pictures on television and media and on the internet, we kind of say, oh, God, it's so bad. What can I do? I can't do anything. And the fact is that, yeah, we can't solve the entire problem, but through our help, whether it be financial aid to organizations like Save the Children, or whether it be Catholic Relief Services or a number of other organizations, we actually do make an impact and we do kind of provide some relief so that people can at least have some dignity and to be, I guess, I don't want to be over dramatic, but that they don't die, that they can live. So I think that's one of the things which I'm glad you raised that up, that, you know, we can make a difference. And the other thing which I think is, here's, I think it's a real dilemma, is, you know, most refugees, they want to go back home and they regard this as a temporary situation. But as you pointed out, the crisis in Syria is now 5 years old, and who knows when it's going to end. Do you find in your work is that kind of the longer a person is a refugee displaced from their country, kind of some of that is a little resignation, maybe even a more of a, not clinical, but a depression that there's less hope of them going back?
Yeah, I mean, the statistic is that on average, refugees are kind of refugees for about 18, 19, 20 years. So it's not just Syria, sadly.
Yeah.
And we just all have to figure out ways to enable people to cope with that circumstance. I mean, I think one of the things that we're particularly focused on is if you think about the future of Syria and the future of that whole region, I mean, a lot of it does rest in the hands of the youth and the children who haven't grown up yet. And what we're quite focused along with the UNICEF and others, and actually the U.S. government has recently appointed somebody to pay particular attention to this as sort of a no-loss generation. You know, if you want to eventually have Syria get back on its feet and recover, you need a generation of folks that are going to do that. And if a lot of these children are missing out on education, and quite large numbers are, that's a real problem.
In the Middle East, we talked about Syria having kind of displaced, that there are 4 million Syrian refugees. It's not the only country. But if you look at that Middle East area, which countries kind of are the largest host countries where the refugees are settling?
Well, Turkey actually has the largest number of Syrian refugees. It's close to 2 million. And Turkey shares a border with Syria, so that's quite understandable in the north. The next largest host for Syrian refugees is Lebanon, and it's about 1.5 million. And then Jordan has around, say, 700,000 refugees. Those are the larger numbers.
If you were kind of thinking about it in a real quick way, Turkey and Lebanon basically have almost 90% of them or 80% of them,
right.
And then they're scattered in other places. So,
I mean, and I think, you know, it's a real so I guess 2 points there is that everybody's focused on Europe right now, but those are countries that need a lot of support to do what they're doing. I mean, this is not easy for European countries are much better, wealthier and better off than Turkey and Lebanon and Jordan and places like that. So in some respects, it's a challenge, but in some respects, they are better equipped to handle these kinds of challenges. And the world and the U.S. and others need to do sustain an effort to help Turkey and Jordan and Lebanon. And then the second point is that we shouldn't focus solely on the refugee populations, because in Lebanon and Jordan, what I've seen is that the Syrian refugees that are coming into those countries, they're sort of in host communities. So you have to, and these are not well off host communities. So when it doesn't work to have Syrian refugee families get support when next door you have very poor Lebanese families who need support not get it because they're not refugees. So, I mean, the world needs to do it when they go about supporting the refugee populations in these countries. They need to do it in a way where the host communities, which are bearing some of the burden, also get support.
Yeah, good point, Michael. Hey, Michael, thank you so much for being with us. And also, thank you for the work that you do, and thank you for Save Our Children because of the tremendous work that they do. So thanks for taking the time to be with us. We've been speaking with Michael Clausen, who is the Vice President for Policy and Humanitarian Response at Save the Children. We were talking primarily about the crisis of refugees from Syria, 4 million of them primarily in the neighboring countries of Lebanon and Turkey, but spreading out in other places. So, Michael, thanks so much for being with us. We're going to take a break now, and kind of when we come back, we'll speak a little bit closer to home. We're going to speak with Catherine Buckley Browner, who is the Executive Director of Catholic Charities at the Diocese of Springfield, Massachusetts. And we're going to speak about what they're doing up there to kind of do their part to welcome some of the refugees today. And we're going to get, you know, a little bit very down-to-earth and very practical and also but very individual, because when we just talked about 4 million, we're talking about, you know, one or two families who they're reaching out to help. And kind of that's what Pope Francis was calling for. He said that, you know, let's reach out one, two families at a time, welcome those, show them our Christian warmth and hospitality. So we're going to speak with Catherine Buckley Browner about that. But we're going to take a break now. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love, the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and will be more compassionate. This week, we're speaking about the refugee crisis in the world, and it certainly is a crisis that is very much front and center on the mind of Pope Francis, and so much so that when he comes to his trip to the United States and to New York next week, he's going to be visiting with about 150 immigrants and refugees that are helped by a variety of Catholic Charities programs in New York. And so this week on Just Love, we're speaking about that refugee crisis, and we spoke about the big numbers that are in the Middle East and in countries there. But we're also going to speak right now with Catherine Buckley Browner, the Executive Director of Catholic Charities in Springfield, Massachusetts, about what local Catholic Charities agencies are doing to, as we would say, welcome the stranger, particularly those who are fleeing desperate situations in other parts of the world. Catherine, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on Just Love.
Well, thank you very much, Monsignor Sullivan.
That is great. So tell us, just give our listeners just a little bit of sense of yourself, how you got into this this work, and give us a little bit of your own personal history.
Well, that would probably be a much bigger story than you could handle. But I think that I got into the Catholic Charities mode and business because of the fact that I was raised by parents who had me all over the world, and we had the opportunity to live in...
That must have been a long, long period of labor if they had you all over the world.
It was. Just ask my mom.
Okay.
Well, what they did is they had us traveling all over the world, and we had the opportunity to live in different countries in both Europe and Asia. And the opportunity to see people at all levels and to be a part of many different cultures.
Hey, you know, that must have been just so wonderful because, you know, sometimes every now and then we people of the United States, we kind of grow up in our own neighborhoods and you know, we're separated by two big bodies of water. And sometimes we kind of think we're a little bit self-centered, that the whole world revolves around the United States. Boy, you were really kind of blessed and fortunate to kind of experience the diverse cultures and places throughout the world.
Yes, I was. And taking away from that, I was able to then have the equal blessedness to be invited to be a part of Catholic Charities. I worked with Catholic Campaign for Human Development and Catholic Relief Services, and we still actually have those as part of our office. And eventually Catholic Charities, and not only helping those who are overseas, but being able to turn to our brothers and sisters here in our own community and see in them also the not only the diversity of culture, but all the various levels of issues that need to be addressed by us as Catholics.
So, Catherine, let's go a little bit. Let's get a little bit specific for a moment, because how are you working with or helping out some of the refugees that we were talking globally about before in Springfield?
Here in the greater Springfield area, we actually have two resettlement agencies. One of them is Jewish Family Services, and the other is what used to be known as Lutheran Social Services. Between those two resettlement agencies, we resettle about 600 refugees every year.
Oh, that's a pretty good number.
For Western Massachusetts, yes, indeed it is. We are in the part of the of Massachusetts.
You know, Catherine, I always have to ask this question whenever you mention Massachusetts. But Weston, there's hope for Western Massachusetts. Are you a Boston Red Sox fan?
I don't know how to answer that. I'm not really a baseball fan. So.
Well, okay. Let me tell you the best and most virtuous way to answer that question. The question is, are you a Boston Red Sox fan? The answer is no.
Okay, Spoken is somebody who's probably not a Red Sox fan.
Who? What team? You mean the New York Yankees? Anyway, but I have a colleague at Catholic Charities in New York who is from Western Massachusetts, Pittsfield, and he went the way of kind of death and destruction, and he became a Boston Red Sox fan. So, you know, he's trying to overcome that in a life of virtue, but it's a little bit hard. So,
It is. And he's from probably about as west in Massachusetts as you can possibly get.
Not that I pay attention to this. He's 142 miles from Fenway Park and 142 miles away from Yankee Stadium, and he made the wrong choice. So,
indeed.
So Catherine, so tell us, 600 refugees resettled in Western Massachusetts by both Jewish family services and Lutheran social services. So kind of talk about a little bit what Catholic Charities does to kind of supplement or help out in the work that they're doing.
Well, we do our service to the refugees in sort of a threefold manner. Through Catholic Charities, we have our own immigration services.
Right.
And so with that, what we do is we offer a lot of the services for changing of status, plus which we can feed them into our own social services system. We also offer English as a second language classes, and we also do offer citizenship courses.
Yeah.
Within the diocese itself, though, and Catholic Charities works very closely with them, is we do have priests that are designated as those who welcome refugees who have self-designated as Christian. They become mentors to them. They help them assimilate into the local community. They get them into the churches of worship, which is another community which is really very important. The whole faith-based community becomes really core to many of the populations that are coming here. It is an instant family, if you will, and a way for them to feel more comfortable because they're within a faith tradition that is at least familiar to them. So these are very important aspects of just that whole welcoming and helping people to acculturate as quickly as possible.
To give our listeners a little sense of the 600 refugees in Western Massachusetts, from which countries do they predominantly come?
The four biggest countries that we have been resettling have been Iraq, Bhutan, Syria, Somalia, with rising numbers at this point from both the Congo and some increased numbers from Burundi.
Okay. So tell us, since it's on everybody's mind, tell us a little bit about your work with Syrian refugees.
Well, there hasn't been an awful lot of work with Syrian refugees at this point. As you have seen the numbers yourself, we haven't brought that very many Syrian refugees into this country as of yet. However, we have had five families that just recently have come into this area. So I can't say that it's been extensive work. But what it has caused us to do is really reach out through something that we have here, which is called the Western Massachusetts Refugee and Immigrant Consortium. This is just another one of those processes that really helps to bring families more quickly into resettlement and to help us advocate for their needs. So through the consortium, what we've been doing is we've been bringing together the stakeholders that really need to be in place as the Syrian refugees come to us. Chief among that is making very good contacts and relationships with the Islamic Society here in Western Massachusetts. Our experience has been that these Syrians come here really with no English, and they are traumatized, particularly the children are traumatized. They come here with great fear. But as one of our families said, he said, we wake up in the morning and we remind ourselves that we do not have to be afraid, that we are here now, And that is just something that they have not felt for very, very many years.
Well, that's a very important reality. And I think for many of us who probably have woken up almost every morning of our lives, certainly not being being unafraid that we were going to suffer violence, that's a really powerful kind of statement for somebody to kind of say that. We do take it for granted, and it's really very, very powerful to say that. You know, in the resettlement of people, oftentimes refugees from one country will be resettled in an area where they may not have relatives, but there's kind of the same community that is there. And sometimes they wind up in other communities where there aren't a lot of people from their own country. In Western Massachusetts, is there a significant Syrian population that was there before this crisis?
No, there was not. But there is a very strong, as I said, the Islamic society is a very, very strong society here and has really become the home for many who, though they may not have their own cultural peoples, at least share a fundamental faith experience. And that has been extremely helpful.
You know, it's interesting because in our conversation here, while we have not focused on it, the reality is that we talked about the two major resettlement agencies in Western Massachusetts, Jewish Family Services and Lutheran Services. And now we're talking about the role of the Islamic Society and the work the Catholic Charities is doing. It certainly seems to me that the religious community is a major stakeholder, a major player in this crisis of refugees throughout the world.
I think that that's really true. And if you look at the work that's even being done overseas, you know that Caritas and Catholic Relief Services are also doing enormous work for those who are caught in this big migration. So I think that there is something about the whole idea that the faith-based communities play an enormous role. They can provide, as I said before, sort of that familial welcome to families that are coming into their midst. They are welcoming. They are able to provide acculturation. They're able to provide instant type of friendships and bonding. And then there is the familiarity, as I said, in being able to join with your own faith people.
Now,
at least you have that, even if you don't have your own culture and you don't have the things that you've left behind.
You know, Kathleen, what every now and then I think people may not understand how some of the work that Catholic Charities does is so very sophisticated, professional, difficult that it requires professionals to be involved full time. And that's part of the resettlement work, too. At the same time, what we also realize is that some of those professional services can be complemented by additional work that volunteers might do, that who are members of parishes. And sometimes it's really what they've done has been extraordinary. Sometimes it's a little bit difficult to get them involved. I don't know the answer to this, so I'm just asking you, have you been able to involve any of the volunteers or any parishioners in providing some of that welcoming or support for the refugees in Western Massachusetts?
We've had varying success. We did have for a while, particularly when we were bringing in the very large number of Somali families. We had a lot of families in parishes that volunteered to act as sponsor families. That doesn't mean that they took the families into their own homes, but what they did is they acted as mentors. They went with them. They shopped with them. They explained how to use sophisticated equipment. They helped them get into the schools. They did introduce them to a lot of the different aspects of life in Western Massachusetts. to some extent, we still have that, and we also have individual volunteers who come forward as English as a second language tutors. Can't put too fine a point on the fact that one of the most immediate things that families need to really work on when they come to the United States is rapidly being able to learn some of the language. The employment opportunities, the opportunities to understand and to quickly become part of the community really hinge on their ability to acquire English. So we use lots of tutors from parishes to give one-on-one kinds of work, to work with the children, and to work with the women. The women in many of these groups are usually the last group that is thought of in terms of getting them language and helping them to assimilate into the culture. Much of the focus is put on to the breadwinner, and it's understandable. But in the end, it means that the women are kind of a second or third thought.
Catherine, thank you so much. That gives us a real good sense of what you're doing, the contributions make, the possibilities that are there, and how kind of, you know, in its own way, Western Massachusetts has become, you know, a place that welcoming by the collaboration and cooperation among different groups, and particularly groups that have strong religious traditions. So, Catherine, thanks so much for the work that you're doing, and thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on Just Love today.
Well, thank you very much, Monsignor Sullivan.
Great. Catherine Buckley Browner, the Executive Director of Catholic Charities in the Diocese of Springfield. I am just so delighted that we were able to speak with her and previously with Michael, because it really focuses on what is going to be a major part of Pope Francis's trip to the United States, his focusing on newcomers, focusing on immigrants and refugees. And we're privileged that he will be doing that here in East Harlem in New York, and people from all different parts of the world. Actually, in the room with Pope Francis will be immigrants and refugees from every continent except Antarctica. So, listen, all of listeners, stay tuned to the Catholic Channel next week as we follow Pope Francis, Cuba, Washington, New York, Philadelphia. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Thank you for being with us on Just Love. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
You're listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.